We set out in this forum to try to understand some of the most basic things in Torah thinking, and therefore let's begin this this part of the year with an issue that goes to the heart of Torah and the heart of what it is to be human, which means to the root of the creation itself and the root of the the human dimension, something that's usually completely misunderstood. But let's see if we can try to gain a more mature understanding of this subject than than usually we are left with from our superficial Jewish backgrounds. And that is the question of the very first action, if you like, or the first, the sin of Adam. What exactly happened? And of course, although the issue itself is way above our real understanding, but we should be able to extract from it the universal principles that apply to us, even though he was functioning on a level that we can't really begin to understand intimately. Nevertheless, the Torah describes his or their ordeal, if you like, man and woman, because they really were one fused being. The Torah describes their ordeal and their response to it because we need to learn from it, even though we're not really relevant. Their level and our level are really two completely different things. I hope and I presume that we're all aware. I mean, I presume that anyone who's interested enough to attend Shiurim lectures on these kinds of subjects is already aware that Torah is far deeper than the superficial popular notion of the various events in Torah. In fact, it's reliably accurate to say that the way Torah subjects are usually understood in the street, to put it broadly, is the opposite of the way that they really should be understood. And therefore, I presume that we need spend very little time demolishing or saying that the conventional notion of what happened is is wrong, that he was a human being, he was given a very simple instruction, put in an idyllic situation in a garden, all he had to do was one simple commandment, and he got it wrong. Most people think, you know, if I'd been there, his mistake would have been so obvious, I would have said to him right away, what are you doing? Can't you see this is wrong? And of course, had I been chosen, Hashem made a mistake, should have chosen me. Had I been there, had he given me that test, it would have been child's play. Simple instruction, all you have to do is listen to it, you're guaranteed eternal fulfillment and perfection. He made it such an elementary error, in fact, that it's almost impossible to understand his mentality and his psychology, if you like. The error was so blatant and so so juvenile. Obviously, I presume that anybody sitting here realizes that that cannot be have anything to do with our subject. So our problem is to understand how somebody at his level was able to disobey a divine commandment, which was the worst of all sins that ever took place on earth. It was the primal sin, the one that brought death to the world, the one that brought all the brutality and torment and torture to the world, the one that transformed a few hours of pre-Shabbat experience that would have automatically become the perfection of Shabbos had he done nothing but sit still and obey, transformed all that into 6,000 years of human misery, anguish, brutality. The deeper sources say that there's never been a good day. In fact, if you calculate it carefully, there's never really been a few hours together that have been lived in perfection. From that day on, human history has been a history of anguish. Jewish history has been worse than the rest of human history in terms of its pain and suffering. Even the few moments of seeming perfection, for example, when the Beis HaMikdash was built, the temple was constructed, even there the Gemara says that on the night of its consecration, when King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, built the Beis HaMikdash, and his reign was as close to the messianic picture as you can imagine, 40 years of near perfection, there was no war on earth anywhere, the whole of the human race was ruled by Torah authority, The kings and queens of all the nations brought homage to Jerusalem. There was an idyllic experience on earth. Even then, the Gemara says that at the night of the moment of the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash, at the moment that it was dedicated, the Medrash says that Yared Gavriel HaMalach, the certain spiritual energy was set up in such a way that details are not important, but a reed was driven into the Mediterranean, and around that reed accreted the country of Greece and later Rome, from which emanated the seed of destruction of the very temple that was being dedicated at that time. So he succeeded in transforming a situation of perfection, guaranteed perfection, into a situation of unspeakable horror and brutality. What exactly happened? What exactly happened? What was his ordeal? First of all, how great was he? Again, this is completely beyond our comprehension, but let's just say just a couple of words at least to begin to realize that it's beyond our comprehension. The Gemara says, the Chazal say, the Midrashim say, that he was cosmic, literally cosmic in his proportions. The Midrash says he stretched from heaven, from earth to heaven, whatever that means. He saw from one end of the world to the other, which means, in some very primitive understanding, he had a complete cosmic, universal experience and existence and knowledge. The Gemara says, the Midrashim say that the angels, again, have spent a long time trying to discuss and understand what these creatures are that we call malachim or angels, but whatever they are, they tried to worship him. They got confused. When they saw him, they couldn't tell the difference between him and his creator. There are some Kabbalistic sources that indicate that he was living at a place, I'm not sure it's even permitted for us to say the words, but he was living at a level that today we relate to in divine terms. More details difficult to go into. Just to give you some beginning of an idea, the Gemara says that after he died, after he sinned and died, there was an experience. One of the Tanoim, one of the authors of the Mishnah, had the merit or the task, if you like, to measure graves. His job was to measure the vaults in which various Tanoim people before them were buried. And when he came to the grave of Adam HaRishon, he went into the Machpelah, he went into the grave of Adam HaRishon, where Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava are buried, and Avram and Sarah, the great primal fathers and mothers of the Jewish people, of the world and the Jewish people, four great couples who buried there. And he was allowed to look upon them. The Gemara tells marvelous and amazing things that he saw when he gazed upon the couples who are buried there. But it says he was only allowed to look at Adam at his heels. Because of his supernal level, his body, which lies buried in the Machpelah today, which is in Hebron, Shem Hebron, he was only allowed to look at his heels. And the Gemara records that what he saw when he looked at the heels of the corpse of the man who had sinned and fallen and subsequently died, the light that shone from his heels was greater than the sun. Now the Gemara doesn't exaggerate or use metaphors or that. In whatever sense it's meant, that is its level. That was after he was no longer alive. And you should remember, to understand the depth of this, is that the heels are always the part of the human being that even when you're alive is dead already. The Gemara says, "Ein rekev ba'akev." There's no rotting in the heels. That means when a person dies, you have a tradition that the heels do not decay. They don't decompose. They don't rot. The reason that the heels do not decompose is because even when you're alive, your heels are dead. The meaning of that, a long story, again for another time, but just a brief insight into it is that the lowest part of the human form, the part on which you stand, the part furthest from consciousness, that's the part that is furthest from life, right? The spiritual source is the top, the high point of the human being, where a man wears his tefillin, where there's an open connection, where the bones of a child are open when he's born at the top of the head. There's an intimate connection with the spiritual world. There's much Kabbalistic writing about that. And the lowest part of the human being, the legs, again, the deeper sources say that the legs are not part of the human being. They're labar migufa, they're outside the body. The lowest part of the human is where the level of the bris. That's the lowest part of a man and a woman. But the legs are outside of the body entirely. And the bottom of the legs, the feet, are the part that have no life at all. That's why the thick skin on the bottom of the feet is the dead. That's the dead part of the body. Of course, I'm sure your minds are racing ahead of me. You realize already that that itself was the result of the sin, that because that is the lowest part of the human being, when the serpent, right, when that amazing discussion takes place between God, Hashem himself, and the man, and the punishment is meted out, and it says, Ata teshufenu rosh, you'll beat his head, that means the serpent, his sting and his poison will be in his head, v'hu yishufchar akev, and he will bite your heel. The poison of the serpent, that means the agent of death, is put into the heel of the human form. It means that the human form is full of life, the man was created life itself, which means cannot die. By his nature, he was immortal. That means life is, by definition, that which has no death. Therefore, he was incapable, as it were, of dying. But his heel was the vulnerable point, and it was there that the serpent was, that the poison of the serpent is put in. It means that, and that becomes the point in which, at which death exists in the human being. And of course, the rest of your life is just a question of how much time it takes to spread from there till the vital centers are engulfed. But that's where death begins, even when you are, the rest of you, alive. It's that point, and that part of the human being, the part that is dead even when you're alive, even after he had died, double dose of the death absence, let's say, in that part of the body, the light that shone from where was from there was greater than the sun. So can we begin to imagine what was the level of this supernal human being who was formed to contain all other souls? Again, our deep sources say that in the final stage of the world's history, when everything coalesces and everything reaches back to its point of origin, then all souls will be incorporated again back into that one massive soul which was his or his and hers. So he contained all of humanity, and he was almost divine in his level, and he was given an instruction, told not to eat from the fruit of a certain tree. What does this mean exactly? First of all, I think we've discussed this before on a previous occasion. It needs to be remembered that anything that it says in the description of the creation, you have to understand, unlike the rest of Torah, we have an axiom that the rest of Torah, that Torah in general, is based on four levels. Again, even a beginner should know this. Torah is based on four levels, what we call paradise, the orchard. The orchard of Torah. Pshat, Remez, Drush, and so the four levels of Torah understanding. Pshat means the simple level, so-called simple or literal level. Remez is the deeper, deeper level. Drush is even deeper than that, requires delving even deeper. And so is the secret level or the Kabbalistic level, that which never can be made explicit. Those are the four levels. We have an axiom that each of the levels that you descend to never controverts a previous level. That means if you understand something literally in the Torah, no matter how much deeper you go and discover that what you understood before what you've understood now is something entirely different. A whole new world, in fact, exists at each layer, beneath layer, beneath layer. Nevertheless, each layer of discovery never controverts a more superficial level. That means if it says simply that a man walked up a mountain or people walked through a desert, it always means that. Even at a deeper level, walking up a mountain always means a spiritual elevation. And walking through a desert always means a journey spiritually through death forces. But the simple level is never controverted. If it says they walk through a desert, it always means that, literally. And therefore, the most basic understanding of any verse in the Torah is that the simple level always means exactly what it says. If it says, whatever it says, they walk through a desert, a man did an action, he struck a rock, he spoke to a rock, it means literally that's what happened. Of course, the deeper message, and perhaps the more important message, is something that lives beneath the surface, and there's something beneath the surface of that, and so forth and so on. But the simple level always is true, and therefore, the simplest level of pshat, what it says in the simple so-called storyline that even a six-year-old can understand, that is always true. But there's one exception. There's one exception. The way it goes in Torah is that the simple level means literally what it says. What is the deeper level? What is the hidden fourth level, the Kabbalistic secret level? That you spend a lifetime of delving and refining your character and refining your intellect and your sensitivity in order to begin to grasp some beginning understanding of what that deep level is. There's one exception, and that's the description of the creation. The whole first part of Chumash that describes the creation and the events that surrounded what happened in the garden, including our subject this evening, that whole subject is exactly opposite. There, in that core of creation, in that initial description of the Torah, there, our commentaries say that what's being described there, what the simple meaning of the words is the deepest Kabbalistic level. What it looked like, literally, if you spend years refining your character and refining your intellect and your sensitivity, you can begin to perhaps grasp something of what it looked like, literally. That's the beginning, that's the nucleus, and there what's being discussed openly, without any coverings, is the inner meaning itself. From then on, from that description on, there's a switch, and what then becomes discussed is the outer level, the clothing, just like you see a human being, you see them through the outer garments. And you have to delve to see inwardly. But there, the beginning of the Torah, the beginning of the description of creation and those events, what's being discussed there is the inner meaning itself in words that have no clothing, no covering. And therefore, it's a tragic error to try to picture the events with the eyes that we have now. To picture a man and a woman who lived in a garden without clothes and they took leaves and they were... and a serpent that walked upright and eventually was cooked. To think of those things literally the way you picture them now is by definition incorrect. That some Torah educators say that this is a reason that pictures should not, children should not be given pictures in Torah education. Not of anything in Torah, but certainly not of that. Certainly not that. People want to bring it down to a child's level, so they make stories of Bible stories and they illustrate them. So they illustrate them, so the child gets a picture that doesn't look much different than the what no adult should be looking at. There's a question about whether later events in Torah should be depicted. Even that's problematic, certainly. The faces, that's another whole debate about whether it should or shouldn't be. But to picture those events, you know, we're talking about something far higher than our present scale of reference. Now, with that background, let's try to understand what happened. He was commanded not to eat, or they were commanded, I'm going to say he from here on in, although it was really the two of them as a team, it was really she who became vulnerable, and she became vulnerable because he made an error. See how much time we have to go into what level of detail, but he or they were given a command not to eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Each of these elements needs full discussion. Let's try and pick our way through at least one thread of depth here. The first thing to understand is that he had no intrinsic desire. He had no inner pull to evil. That's the first thing to understand. Not only had no inner pull, but he was the very opposite of the way we are now. We have a pull to evil. That means to lowliness. We have what we call, what in Torah terms is known as the Yetzirah. Yetzirah, evil inclination. But it means all the vested interests. It means all the pull to sensuousness and lusts and drives and laziness and earthiness. All the animalistic, all that part that you have naturally, all that a child has without having to work on. Those things that you have naturally, he had none of that. He had none of that. He had no pull to evil. He had no inner drive or desire to do anything illicit. He was a pure, absolutely pure intellect. All he was an absolutely clarified and pure intellect. His body was a completely loyal servant of his intellect. Today we are cast into opposition with our bodies, into paradoxical opposition. Our bodies move one way, and our higher intellect, when occasionally it speaks, pulls in the opposite direction. Our bodies pull to earthiness, to lowliness, to sensuousness. His body didn't do that. It's incidentally the reason why his body was unclothed. The reason that they had no clothes on was because there was no reason for shame. The body was a perfect vehicle, perfectly in harmony with the inner content. The body wasn't pulling in an opposite direction. The body was a perfect vehicle in complete harmony with the neshama. So there was nothing to be ashamed of. The body could be revealed for what it was, and the neshama was revealed for what it was. In fact, the body itself was so rarefied, the sources say that the body itself was spiritual. And will be again one day. A very, very crude analogy would be that, just to begin to understand the reversal that has happened, our bodies pull in the opposite direction, so they become shameful. Our bodies are shameful because instead of being loyal vehicles and loyal servants, loyal vehicles for the neshama, for the soul that's contained within that body, our bodies pull in the opposite direction. So we caught in the paradox. We have the stigma, we have the paradox of being angelic in our intrinsic natures and living in an animal's body. Our bodies are animal. They do look like animals' bodies. The scientific observations about the human body are quite correct. We do, definitely no question about it. And we feel the shame of living within a vessel or a vehicle that wants to pull in one direction while we know that our inner energy pulls in a different direction. So we try to hide the body, of course, in subject of clothing, and how we correct that shame is another question. We try not just to cover the body, we try to show dignity in the body. That was one of the lessons that Adam himself learned. After the sin, he took leaves to cover his nakedness, but just to cover the lowliness and the animalistic aspect of his lowliness, of his nakedness. And Hashem came and sewed garments for him. Sewed complete garments for him. The concept being that there are two elements in clothing. One is the hiding of nakedness, and the other is revealing the glory, revealing the dignity of the wearer. Clothes do both those things. He paid attention to the lower function of clothing, which is the part that clothes specifically the lower part of the body. And Hashem came and taught him that now the place of your breakdown has to be the source of your correction. And he's showing that we don't only use clothes to hide the nakedness, we use clothes to show dignity. So he sewed for him much fuller garments, the ones that reflected. But he wasn't... The crude analogy would be that if you look at a human being today, you see an animal. You see an animal, look at a human being. If you make scientific, accurate, objective observation of a human being, you see an animal, you see tissue, you see flesh. You see, where do you see the difference between a human and animal? If you take the human species, as they call it, take a human being, strip off the clothes of dignity, and you compare that human to a gorilla or a horse, tissue is the same, physiological, anatomical functioning is exactly the same, where do you see the difference? So the deep sources say the only place you can see the difference is on the face, what we call zivaponim, it's the glow on the face. And skipa sakoma, the erect stature, vertical stature of a human being, animals don't have that. Sometimes the hands express something that animals cannot. But the face essentially is where you see it. What is it you see on the face? There's a glow. A human being, especially someone who's refined himself and worked on himself, a person who guards what he looks at, guards what he hears, there's a certain refinement. You can see it. A boy comes to yeshiva, a young man comes to yeshiva. You sometimes see a person who's come from a world of very, very physical pursuits. And after a few months of the agony, of the brutal agony of working with Torah, you see a change in the face. It's a remarkable thing. Remarkable thing. Rasim Chabasiman told me that if you ever saw the Chofetz Chaim once, you were never the same again. I never saw him, of course. I know that if you ever saw Rav Simcha, you were never the same again. But there's a zivapan, there's a glow on the face. How strong is it? You could miss it easily. Miss it easily. It's a very, very faint glow that says that this human being you're looking at is different than an animal. But when you looked at Adam, when he was created, it was exactly the opposite. When you looked at him, all you saw was the light. That means today, you look at a human being, you see an animalistic body, and if you look very carefully, you can see a faint glow that is different than an animal has. If you looked at him, you saw the opposite. All you saw was an incandescent light. And if you look very carefully, you could make out the wisp of a body. It was like looking at a very, very bright light. You had to shield your eyes. Look at a very bright bulb, all you see is the light. If you look very carefully and painfully, you can make out the wisps of the glass that's around it. That's how he was. That's how he was. He was luminescent with spirituality. He had no desire to do anything wrong. He had no drive to do anything wrong. Again, you know, perhaps the way for us to feel this is, understand carefully. How does the Torah describe his seduction, her seduction, the two of them? What happened? The snake, the serpent appeared, and became a force of seduction from without, not from within. No voice spoke from within. There was no inner voice saying, craving or desiring. There was a voice. The reason that the Torah posits, that the concept here is that the serpent speaks from without, because there was no inner voice of evil. There was only a source from the outside. The serpent appeared as a force from without. Inside there was only purity. So the serpent appeared and said, you should taste. You won't die, it'll be good, you'll be like Hashem, etc. He had no inner voice like that. Today we flipped into the exact opposite. Today the voice speaks from within. In fact, today it's almost all that's left. Now, this illustrates it most beautifully and most humiliating fashion. If this fails to humiliate, it's only because the reversal is so complete that there's no further hope for a person, right? At least if a little humiliation is felt when you realize this, at least a little humiliation is at least some hope. What is the humiliation? Is that he was created in a situation where the voice spoke to him from the outside. His inner voice was a voice of only goodness. Only doing what was right. Only obeying Hashem. His only concern was his bond and his oneness with Hashem and bringing Hashem's revelation into. That's all he was concerned about. The voice spoke from outside. Taste the fruit. It'll be good. You'll become like this. You'll do this. You'll do it. Today we function exactly the opposite. Today when we want to do something wrong, it's the inner voice that speaks. And the voice of conscience speaks from outside. If you deny this, you're lying, or you're so unaware of your own inner being that it's just not true. How is that? Something sensuous or pleasurable. What voice speaks? Ooh, I'd like to do that. Me. That's me. That's I. I'd like to do that. And what is the voice of conscience? You know you shouldn't. You. You know you should. You. What's speaking from inside and what's speaking from outside? That isn't humiliating. I don't know what is. Whatever the pleasure is, whatever the sensuous pleasure or lust is, it's the me. I'd like to do that. Me, definitely. It's first person, no question about that. And the voice that, and it's usually a very thin, small voice, and it's usually heard from a very great distance. But you know you shouldn't. You know you shouldn't. That's where we are. We don't need any serpent speaking from the outside. He's a resident. He's a permanent resident. The Gemara says the way it goes is that initially he passes by in the street as a passerby. Opens the door for a handout. Before you know it, he's no longer a passerby. He's a guest in the house. And before you know any beyond that, he's no longer a guest. He's the resident and you're a guest. That's how it is. Our lower drives, they're not asking for handouts and they're not guests. That's the you, that's the me, that's the resident. If you're lucky, you're allowed in sometimes as a guest. Maybe you get a handout. Occasionally, once in a lifetime. That's the reversal that's taken place. Now the problem becomes, let's follow this through carefully. The problem becomes, if he had no drive to do anything wrong, how did he fail? He was only concerned with what was correct. He had no desire to do anything wrong. In a sense, he couldn't. So what was the appeal of the serpent who said, you need to taste the fruit? If you translate it into your terms, ooh, it looks luscious, delicious, I'd like, that's not relevant to him. The Rambam, just to try to put this a bit more clearly, perhaps the best expression of this that's ever been a classical exposition of this idea, hopefully this will make it clearer. In a classic and a famous piece in the Moreh Nevuchim, The Guide to the Perplexed, the Rambam says, it's a stupendously brilliant insight into this idea. The Rambam says that Adam HaRishon, Adam, had no ordeal between good and bad. He could not register good and bad. He had no concept of goodness and badness. He only had concept of truth and falsehood. His ordeal, his temptation, all he could realize, all he could conceptualize, was truth and falsehood. He couldn't conceptualize good and bad. Good and bad are always admixtures. Good always means something that on balance is good. Bad always means something that on balance is bad. This needs further discussion and elucidation. But truth and falsehood, the difference between good and bad, and truth and falsehood, is that good and bad are values. No matter how extreme you make them, they're two opposite values. But truth and falsehood are not two different values. Truth is everything and all that there is, and that which only there is. And falsehood means that which does not exist. It's not relevant. It's not relative to truth. It's not less or worse. It just does not exist at all. In other words, his ordeal was, if you do not eat from the fruit, if you exist the way you are, obeying the divine command, you are real. You exist. That's the truth. If you go against the divine commandment, that's not bad. That does not exist. You're moving out of existence. To go against you have to understand that the divine command, Hashem, is reality. And what he says and what he wants is the definition of reality. To go against that is not disobeying a commandment, it's walking out of reality. The act of suicide pales into insignificance compared to that. Completely into insignificance. This is not suicide, this is stepping out of reality. To do that which he says don't do, to go against what he wants and what he commands, is to walk out of existence. The Mephoshim say that he heard it in the way that angels hear it. Angels hear that disobeying a commandment, they hear, is a passing out of existence. That's why they think that we are ludicrous. The Kabbalistic sources say the angels laugh at human beings. They laugh at you and see a human being giving in to a lower desire and doing something wrong. From the angel's point of view, he sees you walking out of existence. You think you're doing something pleasurable. He sees you walking, for the half hour that you spend doing that, he sees that when the truth is revealed and you finally come to a world in which your life is clarified, that half hour you spent out of existence. Much worse than that, but at least out of existence. An angel doesn't sin because he sees clearly. The only reason we sin is because we're confused. We're in a world of darkness where our bodies pull one way and we see good and bad. But all he saw was truth and falsehood. Disobeying the command was moving out of existence entirely. Now the problem's worse. So if that's who he was and all he saw, he had no inner drive to do anything wrong. And all he saw was truth and reality. And he was close to that reality. He spoke face to face with Hashem. And the only option he had was to do an act that would be disappearance, complete moving out of existence. So what was the temptation? What was the difficulty of this ordeal? And how did he succumb to it? So let's try to understand. obviously, the only way to appeal to him, to tempt him, was to put him in a situation in which his good side, understand carefully, these are not easy ideas at all, his good side, his side of truth, and his side of elevation, and his side of drive to closeness with Hashem, obviously that is where his ordeal had to be placed. Let's try to work it out. Again, I'm describing here, what we're studying this evening is what happened to him. What you should be hearing, what we should be hearing, is what's happened to you. We're talking here about this problem in its universal form. But obviously what we wish to extract from here, and the Torah doesn't tell us about him for his humiliation. The Torah tells you about him for your humiliation. For us. So, we need to extract out of it the universal Elul tonight, Rosh Chodesh. This is the time we move into the critical phase of self-examination in the year. Individually. Reconstructing his thoughts from the great teachings of our sages, the Chazal, the process went something like this. Hashem said to him, do nothing. Don't eat from the fruit. You note that his only command was a negative one. He wasn't given a positive command. Actually, he was also given positive commandments. It says he was put in the garden, la'avdo l'shamra, to work it and to guard it. To work it means to build the garden. What his positive command or commands were, I'm not going to go into now. It's a difficult subject. But his explicit command was a negative one. Do not damage the world. Don't damage it. I built a perfect world. The Medrash says Hashem took him around the garden and he said, Ray, come on, nice. See how beautiful is the garden I've put you in. Tein da'atcha. Put your mind to it. Do not destroy it. Don't mess up. Don't break. Don't damage what I built. His only commandment was a negative one. Don't mess it up. Don't break it down. He was handed a delicate, fragile piece of glass sculpture and Hashem said, don't drop it. It's perfect. There's nothing dangerous or jagged or illogical about it. It's an absolute perfect harmony. Just don't drop it. That's all. All he was given to do was just to hold it. That's all. Don't improve it. That doesn't need any improvement. Can't be improved. Just don't break it. And he smashed it and dropped it. He smashed it. And now we have the jagged pieces of dangerous broken glass to deal with. No, he didn't. He made that, not Hashem. Now the structure doesn't look like it's organized at all. Now it's only broken pieces. So Hashem said, don't do it. Don't eat the fruit of the tree. I'll fly this planet. You're a passenger. So he turned to Hashem and he said, passenger? That's what you created me for? To do nothing? Created me to do nothing? You gave me this almost divine level, this cosmic power, in order not to use it? And Hashem said, yes. That's right. Give it back to me. Give it back to me intact. Do not use it. So he said to himself, but what does Hashem really want from me? What does he really want from me? Does he really want that? He has put me in a world where I'm distant from him. Why has he put me in a world distant from him? Why has he built a world that is other than or separate from him? In order to give me the privilege of being able to bring it back to him. That's the reason for the creation, there's no question. A world perfect ab initio could have been done, only the human being. The whole reason for the creation of the human being is to give him, you, me, the work of being able to bring it back to its source so that you have a hand in its creation. That's the reason that's the reason that the human being is created as a creator. It says last, so it's in order to do. You were put here to be a creator. Why is that? Again, another subject for full discussion. The Ramchal puts it very... All the sources say the reason is because if you were the recipient of Hashem's goodness, if you were built, created in intimate and close, endless, eternal relationship with Him as a receiver, you would feel the shame. You wouldn't feel the ecstasy and the pleasure of being a receiver. You would feel the shame of being given that for free. And therefore you were given a world with a task to do, even though his task was minimal. His task seemingly minimal. Just don't damage. But if he fulfilled his task, and we'll see that it wasn't minimal, it was the biggest ordeal that any human being could begin to conceive. If he did his task, if he fulfilled his task, he would bring it back to its source. And he would be responsible for the final perfection. That Hashem and him would be partners. So that instead of feeling the shame of being given it for free, the Namadik Sufa, what's called the bread of shame, he would experience the not giving of charity, but the earning of salary. And then it would not only be his, but it would be his by his own creation. It would really be his. Not a receiver, but a creator who built it for himself. There's a further question here, which is, why did Hashem have to create him with a sense of shame? That's a deep question. Why did Hashem create him with a sense of shame so that now he had to go through the difficulty of experience in order to earn it? Why didn't Hashem just give it to him for free and make him love it? Again, you can do anything he wants. So why didn't he create a human being? Why did he set himself up this problem? Creates a human being, wants to give him eternal ecstasy, the next world, Jean-Paul says. But in order to get the next world as eternal ecstasy, you'd feel the shame of being given it for free. So he put him into this world first, which is difficult and has ordeals. In his case, one ordeal. So that you can earn it. So when you get it over there, you won't feel humiliated. You'll feel you earned it. Simple question. Why not create him with it for free, without any dangers, without any ordeals, and love it? But the answer, again, a little thought will show you that the eternal, the reward, the experience of the next world is none other than a oneness with Hashem. It's an identity beyond human beginning of human conception, but it's a oneness. It's being one with Hashem and yet conscious of that oneness. Something like what an ideal marriage should be. Being bonded into a oneness and yet aware of one's own existence within that oneness. If Hashem would give that, you have to hear this carefully, you have to hear this well. If Hashem would give that to the human being, he would give the human being an experience of oneness with him that the human being never earned, you wouldn't be one with him. There could be no greater gap between you and him. If he's the ultimate and complete giver, and you the complete receiver, then you would by definition be opposites. How can you be one with an opposite? Again, if he would be the giver, and you'd be the receiver entirely. You have no free choice at all. No ordeals to overcome. None of your own work. He gives, you receive. You'd be as unlike him as it's possible to be. He'd be all creator and giver. You'd be all created and recipient. You'd be so unlike him. To really be one with him, you have to be like him. Almost what he is. How do you do that? Just like he's free to create, he puts you free to create. So that when you create and build it yourself, you're not getting a reward. You're becoming like him. You're building the world in partnership. There's a real closeness. Not a question of humiliation because he happened to create it that way. That means the opposite. So in order to do that, he created man at a distance. You know, some commentaries say, if Adam had opened, isn't an amazing thing, had he opened his eyes in the garden, in his first moment of consciousness at midday, or whenever it was, midday, the Medrash says, on that Friday, when he was created, had he opened his eyes and realized that he was no longer the neshama, that he had been part of Hashem in the spiritual world, that he was now in a situation called earth, despite its incredible ecstasy and its idyllic nature, that incredible garden, had he realized that he was now not one with, but other than, had he realized that, he would have fulfilled his obligation of exile forever. We've never needed any exile. But instead of doing that, he looked around and he thought, this is not bad. He saw the beauty and the ecstasy of his existence without enough feeling the pain of the separation. But in deeper terms, he said to himself this, I've been made other and separate. Why? So that I can bring his honor in the world by giving up this independence and becoming again one with him. Again. Two people love each other deeply, and they're together, there's no proof of that love. When there's a separation, and then one has to fight back to the other against resistance from a situation of separateness, that's a manifestation of the togetherness and the oneness. So Hashem put him at a distance and asked him to come back. So he set himself the following amazing idea. He said, if he's put me at a distance, shouldn't I move a little further away? Isn't that what he wants? If he's put me at a distance and said to me, come back, in order that the gap, closing the gap of moving towards him will be a proof and a manifestation of my love and bring our relationship into the world. Doesn't he really want me to step back even further? After all, am I not copying him? Isn't this what he's shown? He's put me in a world at a distance from him. Why? To fight back to closeness with him. Surely the fitting thing here is to step back even further. If I bring this whole thing down into darkness and then I pull it up into the light, isn't that a real achievement? Isn't that a real showing of his? Aren't I doing... Again, are we together? I want you to prove your love for me. So I say, you know what? While you're standing next to me, there's no proof that you really... I want you to go stand in that room over there, and let's see if you come back. So you stand in the room and you say to yourself... You might very well say to yourself, if this relationship is meaningful, I don't want to be standing in the other room. I want to be standing on the other side of the earth. I want the privilege of swimming the oceans and climbing the mountains and going through fire and water and hell to get back to that oneness. That's a manifestation of love, of oneness. That's my privilege. That's what I was created for. He didn't ask me to do that because too dangerous. He didn't expect that. It's not how a lover behaves. One who loves. But surely that would bring... Let me step back. Let me break this thing down. Let's break this thing and piece it together. After all, holding it together, that's a manifestation of my love and my input. And break it down and piece it back together, cutting my hands. Ah, it says I'll die. I'm prepared to go through death. But on the day you eat from the fruit, you will surely die. That's fine. I'm prepared to go through anything. I want to give my life. I don't want to sit and be a passive passenger. He flies, I'm a passenger. That shows that I want to slow it down and move it up. It was like a man in a rocket ship going 1,000,000 miles an hour. He could work the controls by doing nothing to go 1,001,000 miles an hour. That's an achievement. And I have only a few hours to do it. My entire existence forever will be the result of these few hours of doing nothing. Let's slow this thing down. And then let me build it up with my blood and life. Where did he get such an idea from? He made it up. He didn't make it up. That's what he was created for. He reasoned that he was created for that. He was put into the world at a distance to close the distance. Wasn't it logical to take that extra step? The problem is he was commanded not to. He was commanded not to. You think he forgot about that? If I put you in a situation, if you put in a situation where somebody you're dealing with, you know that person knows what you, the person's beyond any reproach or any questioning. And the person says, look, there are two ways to do this thing, and you may not understand the difference. In fact, to you, one way may seem a lot better than the other, but don't do it that way, do it my way. Now you're left with a dilemma. Look, this way looks much better. But I was told to do it this way. Now, you know that the person you're dealing with, the one you're dealing with, don't make any mistakes. You know that he knows more than you. Well, what are you going to do? A sensible human being, I mean, the old story that everybody must have heard that illustrates it, some Torah sources use this beautiful story, I mean, it completely illustrates the point. The Marshal of Chofetz Chaim brings of the man who was a friend of a king. And the king said to him, that this man came to the king one day and he asked permission from his friend, the king, if he could go to a ball, a party of the nobles, that the nobles were making that evening. The king said, you can go to that party, but on one condition, no bets. Lay no bets, no wages. Simple request. He agreed. Went to the party. The next morning he came back to the king. King said to him, how was the party? How was the banquet? He said, fine. King said, you lay any bets? He said, just one. But when your majesty hears what an easy win it was, you'll definitely agree that I should have done it. What happened? I walked into the banquet hall. All the nobles gathered around me, and they offered me a bet for 50,000 rubles, right? They that I have a hunchback. I haven't got a hunchback. So I rolled up my shirt and collected 50,000 rubles. What's the problem? The king said, you fool. They took me on a bet for 100,000 rubles that they could make you roll up your shirt in public. You have a calculation. It seems obvious. But you've been told by somebody whose calculations are more than yours not to do it. Any intelligent individual knows that you obey the instruction. You think for a moment he thought his judgment was better than Hashem's. He knew that the instruction outweighs. He knew that the instruction outweighs his calculations. Sure, it would be more honor for Hashem if you moved further in order to get back. But he said, don't do it. And here we come to a major Torah principle which is immensely, immensely difficult. Frighteningly difficult. And let's see if we can try and explain it. Again, this can be very badly misunderstood, so let's go extremely carefully here. This is a critical issue at the center of Torah, and is liable to be extremely misunderstood. Reb Chaim Shmuel, it's a difficult subject. A difficult subject, what can we do? Reb Chaim Shmuel used to say, great Rosh Yeshiva of Mir, I never had the privilege to know him, but I heard from one of his Talmidim, personally, who heard it from him, and a lot of it's written in his Sefer, which you can look up yourself. He used to say like this, listen carefully, the whole Torah is easy. The whole Torah is, there are no doubts in the Torah. The Torah is easy. There are only three things in Torah that are difficult. The Torah is easy. You have your instructions. What's the problem? You have instructions. There's no doubt in Torah. A Jew is bound by every action. What you do as you open your eyes in the morning, it's lay down in shul. The first thing you think, the first words you say, as you open your eyes in the morning, before you think a thought, you say, Moteh, Anil, Fanecha. You thank Hashem for having woken up. Then you wash your hands three times in a particular order, and you do exactly the number of details written in Shulchan Aruch from the time you open your eyes until the time you're having breakfast, chapters. Yeah, no problem. There's no doubt. From the moment you open your eyes to the moment you go to sleep, from the moment you're born until the moment at the end, it's all, and even beyond, it's all written exactly what you have. There are no doubts in Torah. All you have to do is know the Shulchan Aruch. You have to know the code of Jewish law. We have another category of doubt. It's not tonight's subject. We have a category of doubt because in all of Halacha, the principle is clear, but the application is always grey. Again, the problem is that there are many situations in Torah where the principle is clear, but when you go and apply it in the world, the situation is vague. That's not a problem with the principle. That's only a problem of the professionalism and the greatness and the objectivity to analyze correctly the situation. Every field's like that. Every professional medicine's like that. In medicine, what you learn at medical school is absolutely crystal clear. There's no problem with any of the principles. It was absolutely clear. Every organ works and every hormone and every part of the body and what every single thing's supposed to do is written out in absolute, unequivocal, perfect detail. But when the first patient is lying in a bed in front of you and all of it's swimming out of focus at once, what exactly is happening and how the principle applying is very vague. Very vague indeed. That's what professional expertise means, is to see which principle applies and how. And to cut it finely. That's what Das Torah is, by the way. However, there's another area of doubt in Torah that's much more intrinsic, much more essential, much more central. That's what we need to discuss now. But again, this is fraught with danger and fraught with difficulty. There's no subject in Torah probably more difficult than this. So let's proceed very carefully. There are three things in Torah that are genuinely difficult. Reb Chaim used to say there are three things that are difficult. One of them is called Avera Lishma, a sin for the right reason. The Gemara says, an Avera Lishma, a sin for the right reason, Avera Gedola, Avera Lishma, Yesu mi mitzvah shelo lishma. That an Avera, a sin done for the right reason, is greater than a mitzvah done for the wrong reason. There are times when the Torah wants you to transgress. There are times when He wants you to transgress. When the correct action is a transgression of a commandment. That's problematic. There are two other areas which we won't have time to discuss this evening. One is called Es Lasos Lashem Heferus Rasecho. There's a time to act for Hashem. They have annulled your Torah. It means that there are times when human beings have to annul an aspect of Torah. I can't now go into exactly what that involves. And there's a third one called Bituloi. Bituloi shel Torah zehu yoseida, or sometimes it's referred to as Bituloi zehu kiyumoi. That it's the annulment of Torah that is the fulfillment of Torah. I mean, a simple example, a very, very simple, almost childish example would be that the annulment of a mitzvah sometimes is the fulfillment of a mitzvah. For example, if you're sitting and learning Torah and you get tired, get exhausted. So you have sometimes an ordeal, you wish to stop for a rest. On the other hand, stopping for a rest, you're stopping learning. But unless you're going to rest, you can't learn. So sometimes the desisting from the mitzvah is the only way of fulfilling the mitzvah. Now that's a very, very simple example. But the difficult, this category is difficult because you have to do something that's wrong because in this situation it's not wrong. Imagine the difficulty. You're sitting in a situation, you're being commanded to do a certain thing. Commanded openly. You know that your calculations are so vastly inferior to the command that it doesn't even come into... The discussion of your calculation against His command is not even beginning. Then you think to yourself that there are times when the Torah wants you to transgress a commandment. That's an ordeal. There's one, let's try and discuss this carefully. There's one simple category here, which is sins that were done for the right reason before the Torah was given. Yaakov Avinu married two sisters, which one is not allowed to do? Amram married Yocheved, his aunt, which one may not do. Now, these things were done before the Torah was given. There, Reb Chaim says, this doesn't even... Again, many of the elements that we need to discuss here apply, but before the Torah was given, there were things that were... After the Torah was given, you may not make such calculations, it would seem. After the Torah was given, you may not make such calculations. Classic example that's given is when King Chizkiah was dying, Isaiah the prophet, came in to see him. He came to tell him that he would die. He came to prophesy to the king. Chizkiah was one of the greatest kings that the Jewish people ever had. Incredibly great. The Gemara says he could have been the Mashiach. He fell below the level of being the messianic figure himself by a hair's breadth. And when he was very ill, Yishai came in to see him and told him that he was going to die. So why was he going to die? Yishai said, because you failed to fulfill the commandment of having children. You were commanded to have children, and you avoided having children. So Chizkiah said, I gave up that mitzvah because I saw prophetically who my children would be. He saw prophetically that his son would be Menashe. Menashe was one of the worst kings that the Jewish people, he led the Jewish people astray in an unspeakable fashion. So Chizkiah said, I saw prophetically that my son would be Menashe. So I calculated that for that, you bring a child into the world for that? That incredible discredit? So I decided not to have children. So Yishai turned to him and said to him, who are you to make calculations? Who are you to make calculations? V'hadat kavshe d'rachmona l'malach, which means, you need to put your head into his calculations. He's given you a commandment. Well, your job is to follow instructions. What will happen ultimately? It's his problem, not your problem. He's running the show, knows what he's doing. If he gives you instructions, knowing all that will come out of it, you start making calculations bigger than his. And he was told he's going to die because of that. So Chizkiah said, you're right. And it says he turned his face to the wall and he davened. And eventually he said to the tshuva, and he said to Yeshaya, that if that's the correct calculations, I'll have children. And then he said, and this son of mine, he challenged Yeshaya to get his daughter to marry his son. Anyway, that's not the... What happened was Menashe was born and he lived many years after that. The point is that to make your own calculations to go against his, however, there are circumstances in which you have to do it. Even after the Torah has been given, the Torah greats made a decision to do a sin. What are the classic examples? Now, there's much too much detail here to go into fully. Just try and bring out the principle. The classic example the Gemara talks about is Lot and his daughters. In fact, that's where the Gemara brings it. Lot was in a cave. You know, I'm sure you're all aware of the story. Lot and his two daughters fled the destruction of Sodom, of Stone, and they were living in a cave, and the girls were under the impression that the world had been completely annihilated. There were no men left. There were no human beings left. The only human beings left on earth were Lot himself and his two daughters. So the older said to the younger, let us give our father wine to drink, and when he's drunk, we'll have a relationship with him, and we'll bring seed into the world, we'll bring children into the world, we'll repopulate the planet. They don't understand this. They weren't aware that a city had been wiped out. Stoim and Amora were the entire empire, the culture of the time. They were under the impression that the world was desolate, that they were living on a barren planet, nuclear fallout, nuclear war, that kind of Armageddon scenario that some of us sometimes picture. Not that unrealistic. They thought it had happened. They thought they were living that scenario. And therefore the world... So they said to themselves, you may not have a relationship with your father. On the other hand, that's debatable. Before the Torah was given, it's all without the details now. You may not have a relationship with your father, woman. On the other hand, this is the end of the humans. The Gemara says what the older daughter did in having a relationship with her father was a sin for the right reason, and the Gemara says greater than a mitzvah. And the classic examples, that's brought there in the spot, the Gemara mentions, commentaries mention the classic example, Yael. Yael was the wife of Heber, well-known story. Yael was in her tent, and the Jewish people were threatened by being decimated by Sisera and his army. And the Jewish people were victorious in that particular battle, and Sisera was fleeing. He was fleeing, fled the battle, and he was escaping. And he came past the tent of Yael. There was a prophecy that he'd be destroyed by a woman. The simple meaning was Devorah, right? Deborah, the prophetess, who was leading the battle against Sisera with her husband Barak. She led the battle. She was the leader of the Jewish people at the time. Barak was the military leader. She was the leader of the Jewish people. She was the judge at the time. They destroyed the enemy, but Sisera escaped. And as he fled past the tent of Yael, she realized that the only way to save the Jewish people ultimately here, this man had to be killed. She was a woman. So she invited him into the tent, and the details can't go into, but it says she had a relationship with him, she gave him milk, and the details need to look up yourself. This is not the forum in which to discuss them. But finally, she was able to get him into a situation by having a forbidden relationship with a married woman. When he was finally in a situation where she put the tent peg on his temple and she drove it through his head into the ground. And he was destroyed by a woman. Then the question is, she was a married woman. She was a married woman. For a married woman to have a relationship that she initiated the relationship. The Gemara says if a woman is involved in an intimate relationship where she's married, and she does not initiate the relationship, if she's raped, she doesn't have to die, she doesn't have to give up her life. But if she initiates it, she has to die rather than do that. It's one of the three things in the Torah you have to die rather than do. Idolatry, murder, and sexual immorality. You can't do that. A man's not allowed to do that. Even on threat of death, you can't do that. So a married woman, she'd have to die. So Gemara says, and the details again are not for going to now. The Gemara says if she's completely passive, that means she's the victim. She's the object. She's raped. So she doesn't have to die. But to initiate the relationship, she brings Sisera into her tent and she is the initiator of the relationship. She's a married woman. She had to die rather than do that. Demot is an Aver Lishma. An Aver Lishma, it was a sin for the sake of what had to be done. And for that, that action is greater than a mitzvah. Ah, you're not allowed to make calculations. This is the category of Aver Lishma. However, there's one characteristic of an Aver Lishma that makes it, and it's for this reason that for us it doesn't count at all. Not only because we live after the Torah has been given, but this, before anybody thinks, you know, they're going to go out and got a few juicy mitzvahs, yeah, to attend to, that they're going to, that they know exactly how to achieve, yeah. So what I'm about to tell you outlaws any beginning consideration of that. And the reason is, says Reb Chaim, the absolute precondition to this is that Avera Lishma means a sin. Lishma means for its own, that means Lishma for Hashem's sake. It means, difficult to translate, it means an Avera Lishma, learning Torah Lishma means for its own sake. Avera Lishma means for Hashem's sake only. Right? And it has to be for His sake only. That means if there's a hint of the vestige of the suggestion of the wisp, of the nuance, of any vested interest, the whole thing's completely invalid. Completely invalid. If you get anything out of it, no matter how ancillary or how small, if you get anything out of it, it's completely invalid, the calculation doesn't begin. Reb Chaim himself asks the question, what about Yael? What about her as a woman? She had a relationship with a man, there's a benefit there, there's something there. And he answers, and the commentaries answer, a woman at her level, to have to do that, that's not a vestige of a hint of pleasure. That is entirely a situation of pain. You understand? Again, this details we can't go into now. But only when you can be absolutely clear, completely clear, that this action that's being done that is a sin is only for the sake of the mitzvah, only for the... That means there's not even a side benefit anywhere that comes into it. Only then is it pure. And if it's lishma, that means completely lishma, then it has to be done. Which is why we are completely out of any consideration anymore for these things. I mean, they're beautiful examples, again, without going to... To give you one example, the Gemara says there, the commentaries say, the commentaries bring it up. Moshe Rabbeinu and Moses, just to give you a beautiful example, Moses himself, Moshe Rabbeinu, on one occasion made a mistake, you know, one of the great aspects of Torah is that our great leaders are openly, their faults are flaunted. Their faults are openly flaunted, and I don't think there's any other system like that, as far as I'm aware. Or let's put it this way, there are many systems where it's completely anathema to even think of an imperfection in the great leader or founder of that. But Torah's not like that. Torah, on one occasion, Moshe Rabbeinu, he said a certain thing and he turned out to be wrong. And he was corrected and he said, you're right. I heard and forgot. Shamati v'shachar, I heard and I forgot. And he admitted that he forgot. And he stood corrected. And the Midrash says he sent messages to the whole Jewish people to tell him that he had forgotten, that he had heard and forgotten. The question is, and it's considered an incredible praise. The incredible praise of Moshe Rabbeinu, that he had the greatness, it says, Shehoida v'loy boish, that he admitted that he was wrong, and he was not ashamed to admit it. The commentaries bring with the most incredible praise that Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, was prepared to admit, publicized to the Jewish people, not only in his generation, but throughout history in the Torah, that he had forgotten. Don't forget, when he said something, when he admitted that he'd forgotten, it had been written in Torah. Every event of his life, those events become Torahs, but all of history, the Jewish people see that he heard and forgot. What an embarrassment, what a shame. The man who brings Torah to the world, who hears it directly from Hashem's mouth, admits that he forgot. For a student to admit that he forgot something his Rebbe taught him is enough humiliation. But for Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, to admit that his very function in bringing the Torah down to the world, that he heard something and forgot it, can you imagine the humiliation? And he admitted that he forgot. Incredible praise of worship. So the commentaries ask, what is that such great praise? He was Ishai Lakimi, was totally, Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest human being. For him to admit that he was wrong, what do you expect him to lie? You think he would have lied? You think he would have pretended? And said that he didn't forget and justified himself? But you're not understanding this here. You understand the depth of Torah. It's such a beautiful thing to understand. It's such a tragedy that it's always understood at its cheap and superficial level. Do you know what the problem was? Do you know what his ordeal was? When he was corrected, and they said to him, you're wrong. Moshe Rabbeinu, for a moment the thought crossed his mind, maybe I should stick to my guns and say that I'm right and you're wrong and change the law and pretend that this is the way I heard it and not admit that I heard and forgot. Why? Maybe this is a time for Eslas or Slashem. Maybe this is a time for annulling Torah and a very Lishma in a sense, right? In other words, maybe I should lie. Why? Because what will happen if I admit that I forgot? Listen carefully to the calculation of a leader of the Jewish people. What will happen if I admit that I forgot? The whole Torah will become in question. If I say I forgot, oh, you're human, you can forget, so how can we rely on the rest of the... You know, the whole Torah we have from His mouth. The only things we heard from Hashem were the first two commandments. The rest, we trust Him. The only things we heard directly from Hashem were the first two commandments. I am Hashem and you shall have none others before me. The rest, the next eight of the Ten Commandments and all the rest of the Torah, we have from Moshe Rabbeinu only. So if he's going to admit that he's vulnerable, if he's going to admit that he's fallible, if he's going to stand there and say, you're right, I forgot, that was wrong. Ooh, the Jewish people can now look through the rest of the whole Torah and say, well, maybe he's wrong about this, maybe he's wrong about that. He shows that he's fallible. For the whole Torah to stand, surely this is an occasion in which he has to say that he's right. Surely that's what Hashem wants here. Surely this is a time, if there ever was one, to abrogate Torah and annul Torah in order to upset a whole Torah. What could be a better calculation? It's a massively powerful calculation. Say I'm right. Don't admit that I forgot. So the whole Torah stands on my shoulders. But you know what his greatness was? When he thought it through carefully, he remembered and realized that although that calculation is undoubtedly true, there's a vested interest. The vested interest is I save face. If you save face, the whole calculation is invalid. If there's any vested interest, you're going to gain anything, no matter how small, you will look better, forget the calculation, admit you're wrong. The consequences, that's his problem, because I'm not allowed to do this. And a very lishma, you can only do when you calculate that it should be done, when it's absolutely pure. But if you're going to gain anything from it, then it's not allowed. It's not allowed, so the whole Torah will collapse. I'm not allowed to do this. He knows what he's doing. And he admits it. There's many, many examples. It's not only in Averis. When Esther had to go to Mordecai, it's often brought down. Esther, when Esther was told by Mordecai, Esther, to go to have a relationship with the king of Ahasuerus, not Jewish king. She was a married woman. She's married to Mordecai. So Mordecai said to her, go to the king. You have to save the Jewish people. Go to the king, she said. If I go to him, I'm committing, I'm a married woman, and I'm going to him. If he has a relationship with me, then I will be the instigator of that relationship. I'll be forbidden to you. I'll lose my share in this world, the next world. I'm not allowed to do that. It's written clearly in Halacha, even to save the Jewish people, you don't have to do that. Not allowed to. So Mordechai said to her, this is the time to go. You have to go to save the Jewish people. But not only is there a question of Avera Lishma there, there's a question the opposite way. She said to him, I don't want to go. So Mordechai said, what exactly is the reason she didn't want to go? Because I'm not allowed to go, I'm a married woman. Mordechai said to her, but if you don't go, and no one finds out you're Jewish, and the Jewish people are destroyed, you might be saved. There's a vested interest there. There's a vested interest there on that side. And therefore your calculations are all invalid. And she said, absolutely. In such a situation, you can't make calculations. She went with Astara, she went. And the Jewish people, of course, were saved. And therefore, Avera Lishma is that category where, when there's any vested interest and there's any personal gain, then the Lishma aspect, let's go back to Adam Arishon, let's go back to Adam. What was his ordeal? Let's take this whole creation and let's make it more distant. Let's break it down. Let's go against the command. Isn't this a situation of a Avera Lishma? He's told me not to do it. But aren't I copying him by doing it? By moving it further away to bring it back? He's told me not to. But the Torah contains the concept of a Avera Lishma. He didn't make this up himself. There is a situation in the Torah where you have to. But what makes it invalid? And what was his vested interest? What was his vested interest? Again, this is too refined for us to, but just to begin to, some beginning of a grasp, and try to finish with this. His vested interest was, he had two options. His ordeal was a knife edge. His ordeal was, look, there are two clear options here. Obey the commandment, do not eat, sit passively, and let him do this whole thing himself. I will be a passenger, I do not interfere, and the whole thing goes back to its source and its perfection. Alternatively, I take action. I do the completely legitimate action of Avera Lishma, which is part of the Torah, and it's the most difficult area of Torah, and it's what a great mind has to apply itself to, because the rest of the Torah is easy, to follow instructions is easy. The real challenge is where you have to do what you're told not to do. What an ordeal. But I'm doing it for him. I'm only doing it for him. I want to move the world into a situation of potential death and brutality, and so I'm only doing it for him. He had no inner drive himself. He was only longing to do what Hashem wanted. He had no drive to evil himself. But he did have a million of a million of a millionth of a something of me. That means if I sit here passively and he does the whole thing, it's only him. What's in it for me? Where's the assertion of who I am? I do nothing. If on the other hand I do this equally valid, 100% equally valid action, it's a Torah action of doing that which you're not supposed to do for the right reason. And there are times in history, as I've illustrated, where it was exactly the right thing to do. Isn't there more Kvod Shemayim that comes out? Isn't his honor and his existence revealed more in the world that way? Isn't my love for him and my subservience to my attachment, isn't it? But the difference is that on that side of the calculation, there was the me, the I. I build it. In the eternal perfection of this thing, there will be the me, what we call, in English, in Western culture, we call it the ego. The me, the I. What he was really being challenged with was, are you big enough to kill who you are? What I'm asking you to do is take your free will and your possibility of asserting that you are and who you are and giving that. Are you big enough for that? That was his ordeal. His ordeal was, do I take this and shecht it? Do I take my yetzer? Do I take my own possibility of asserting who I am? This cosmic, almost divine greatness and not applying it, not expressing it? Do I have the greatness to kill the ego entirely? Or do I go through death and hell and fire and water in order to express it, to give it back? And he chose wrongly. It's not because he went against the divine command. Aver Lishma means you go against the command. The problem is if there's a vested interest in it. And of course you have to realize that even his vested interest was Kedusha. You have to realize that even his vested interest was his greatness. What was his vested interest? Doing something myself, right? Doing something myself. Not just being a passenger. Where did he get that from? Because he was created in the world to do something. He was put here to do something. He knew he was supposed to do something. He knew he was supposed to give himself up and do something. Only the question in his mind was exactly which way. And he put into the world the original seed and nucleus of this problem, of the challenge and the test, the ordeal of being, at the root of all ordeals, of course, and that's what's relevant to us. The root of all tests and ordeals is, do you have the greatness not to go through pain and difficulty? Do you have the greatness to conquer yourself? That's the problem. To assert who you are and go and prove it, like Western culture demands. Show you're a man. Stomp all over them. Be victorious. Beat others down. Assert yourself. That's the Western message. But that's not the spiritual message. The spiritual message, you have the greatness to not do that. You have the greatness to control yourself and be a nobody, which is being... The root of that, of course, is that when you become a nobody, you become part of Hashem. When you annul that otherness, that desire to pull yourself away and stand separate from, when you kill that, then of course you're filled with reality. That's the paradox of existence. Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest human being who ever lived because he was the humblest who ever lived. Only when you can empty yourself entirely of your own, only when the vessel can be completely empty can it be completely filled. When the vessel is trying to do its own, only when the vessel is completely empty can it then be filled with the real substance. And therefore what he was being asked to do was no child's play at all. It was not a simple commandment of don't eat. It was a challenge. It was an incredibly difficult crossfire of the ordeal. What was being asked of him was to give yourself back to me in pristine purity. Give back your neshama to me. Don't use your free will. I've given you your free will not to use, but I've given it to you to give up. And the root of all ordeals is to stay out of ordeals. The challenge of all nisyon is all ordeals. It's not to be victorious in the test. The challenge is not to enter the test. You're showing that you're a coward. It's the power of overcoming the self that is required to stay out of the test in the first place. The Western message is, go into the test, prove it. Kill or be killed. The spiritual message is, you're not here to prove who you are. You're here to prove who you're not. You're here to prove who really is, not you. That's a very hard message. Very, very hard message. That's the real test. That's a real problem. And therefore, our job is to take the road where the ordeal does not exist. The Gemara puts it in its very, very simplistic, almost childlike fashion. Let's give this final example. The Gemara says, if a man comes to a fork in a road, and the one limb takes him home, no problem. The other takes him past an ordeal, it's a river, and there are women in the river, and they're doing some washing, or they're immodestly exposed. So if he takes that road, and he will look at this immodest scene, that will be a spiritual failing for this person who's trying to refine himself. He's trying to get above the animalistic and the physical. So he considers the fork in the road, and he says to himself, well, if I take the road with no test, I just get home. I'm not in the world for that. Surely I'm in the world for facing ordeals and overcoming them. That's the purpose of creation. The very first thing that the human being was given was a challenge of overcoming a test. Let me take the road where the test is and let me not look. So Gemara says, if he takes the road where the women are and does not look, he's called a Rosh, an evil man. An evil man, he failed the test. He failed it. Not only did he fail the test, he failed even to realize he was being tested. The test wasn't whether you look or not. The test is which road will you take? This man wasn't thinking. All he was thinking of, he was looking to be dramatic. There's no mitzvah in the Torah, isn't there? Thou shalt be dramatic. There's no mitzvah in the Torah. He was looking for the test that has drama, that has self. Yeah? And as the great Bala Musa say, that kind of test you can never succeed. Because you either look and you fall into the trap of taiva, physicality, or you overcome it and you fall into the trap of gaiva. Pride. You did it. One way or the other, you're going to fall. Either you'll look and you'll fall into the animalistic, or you won't look and you fall into the trap of me. And therefore, the real test is not whether you'll look or not. The real test is which road will you take. Either road with no test is no test. That's the test. That's the test. Is can you handle that? Can you chicken out? Can you take the road that is not a challenge? Can you do? You know what you have to do to take that road? You have to overcome who you are. You have to overcome even the opportunity to prove who you are. It will always be unproved. That hidden potential will never come out. You'll never deal with that battle and kill that dragon. That's the test. You weren't given it to use. You were given it to not use. In practical everyday life, it's obvious in everyday life, instead of wading into the difficulties, you choose all those options in life that will not be problematic later. You should hang around in good company. Why? Because you won't be tempted in good company. You'll never prove your moral fiber and your... That's exactly what you should be doing. That's proving your moral fiber. You should move into a neighborhood where people do what they're supposed to be doing. You should move... buy a house next to the Mir Yeshiva. Why? Because you live there, you'll live in a dignified fashion. Why? Because you're on the level? No, because you're ashamed. Maybe the Rosh Yeshiva will walk in, you won't look the way you should. It's fine. It's good. It's good. You're coerced. You're coerced by your own previous choice. You should live in such a way that you choose the options of coercion. The secular mind says, no, you should go out into difficulty and do battle. That's battle with the external forces. The real battle is the battle with the internal forces. It's to choose the path of safety, and in doing so, is a real overcoming of the self, not overcoming the external world. This is the discussion of the point of origin here. When man and woman were created, that was the test they were given. The test and the challenge was not overcoming any external difficulties. The challenge and the test was overcoming the internal difficulty. And that's why this month of Elul is the time of inner examination. Elul stands for Anila Doidi Vadoidi Li. I am for my beloved and my beloved is for me. I am for my beloved means only for my beloved. It means there's an entire giving up of the self. And then that beloved is to me.